Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Every Sunday, or most Sundays, when I'm driving into the studio for the show, I listen to Philosophy Talk, the show that precedes this, and I was particularly impressed with the show because it was one of those rare shows of any sort that provided real comfort. You know, I hadn't really quite thought about that, but their point was, and the main thesis of the show was, to be looking at the potential implications for what you do today at work and otherwise for 1, 2, 10 generations from now, assuming the world doesn't come to an end before that. And I ended up feeling like, you know, even if this very show, no doubt, of course, it's going to go into the black hole of radio shows past with 10 zillion other radio shows and blogs and articles and tweets and everything else, but there probably will be 1 or 2 people a generation from now, 2 generations from now, who will read it and hopefully maybe even derive a little benefit. So as you think about your work life and what may seemingly feel relatively not crucial, even in the moment, let alone in the larger scheme of things. Let's take something really trivial. I'll take the most trivial example I can come up with. Let's say you are an accounts payable clerk for a large bank, right? And what you've simply done is made sure that some employee got paid or some business got paid on time and got the right money. There's a lot of implications for that that are positive immediately and down the road. Let's take one little example. If, in fact, the employee got paid on time appropriately, that's going to, first of all, make the person feel okay about, okay, he or she is getting paid appropriately for just for his or her actions. He or she will not be so stressed out as to not be able to afford to pay for life expenses for him and the family. And then that will, in a little sense, improve the interaction between him and his child or her and his child. And that, in turn, is going to make that child better adjusted and be a better parent, a better worker. Of course, I'm taking the most extreme example, and it really is small stuff. But as Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor and philosopher, wrote, the search for meaning is much about what life is about. So even if we have a mundane job, thinking about the fact that there are ripple effects not only now, but maybe even in some infinitesimal way to a next generation and in turn on and on and on, may provide just a little, a scintilla of meaning beyond maybe the way we normally think and can be more motivating. So that was the theme of Philosophy Talk's show last time. I liked it just an hour ago, and I liked it. So I thought I would kick off the show by giving you my reactions to that. The topic one that I've been preparing to talk to you about today, and talk with you about today, is more accurate because I'm going to invite you to call in just a minute. I think about this listenership, and most of us start at the millennials, which is people in their 30s and 40s, and then quite a few boomers, and then maybe even a few people who are older than that. And yet, it is indeed Generation Z that is going to be the next generation that is going to soon run our world. And many of us tend to be in our little silos and don't necessarily spend a lot of time interacting with people from that next generation. But Gen Z, they're typically now spoken of as people who are now 13 to 20. And whether it is they are your coworkers, or they are soon going to be your bosses, or your customers, or family members, I thought it couldn't hurt to do a little deep dive for a couple of minutes at least. I did a deep dive this week into reading a ton of stuff about Generation Z, and I thought I would share what I've learned with you and then invite you to call and tell me if, especially, I know there aren't a whole lot of Gen Z listeners, that is 13 to 20 of the show, but you or somebody who knows Gen Zers, if you would want to add or disagree or amplify. So that's topic one. But I will also, of course, always invite you to call in if you've got a work problem. That is going to be a key focus of today's show. So get ready for that. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem that you'd like help with, I'll be inviting you to call in just a few minutes. Generation Z. Generation Z is the first generation to be a true digital native. They're the first generation who have grown up with a smartphone, and that has had profound implications for the way we must interact with them. They expect information and entertainment on demand, instantly, and in phone-sized bites. Facebook, Instagram, Google, video games, YouTube, definitely. Books? Definitely not. Sorry, schools. So, and there is a quiet belief that if one of them is going to be working for you, and it doesn't have to be, you know, arbitrarily 13 to 20, is it going to be any of younger people? There is this unspoken belief that if you are, for example, a boomer, that the amount of knowledge or wisdom that you have in your brain as their boss, as their coworker, is trivial compared to what they can instantly find on the internet. So, lest you be dismissed as inferior, literally inferior as a source of leadership, mentorship, advice, expertise, you really must become expert at using, certainly, not just using Google, but being a master user of Google. I am seeing a lot of people, including younger people, who when, like for example, when my clients come to my office and we want to do some research on something, I ask them, let's go to the computer, let's see you Google this, you know, like supply chain management in nonprofits or whatever. They're terrible at it. So I advise you to take maybe the best use of your time in both dealing with millennials and Generation Zers and just in terms of expanding your own ability to access knowledge instantly. You really have to become an expert at Googling. Very, very important. And truly, their information is being created in an ever more concise manner on the internet and in an ever more entertaining manner. So there are tons of 1 and 2 minute YouTube videos that are instructional. Twitter has been dismissed by many boomers, let alone the greatest generation, older people. But Twitter is incredibly useful because if you're following the right people, people who you respect, who you value, not just people who are talking about what they ate for breakfast this morning, that you can get in 140 characters, followed by a link, some of the very most potent information. So you may get the most learning per minute of time by simply following Twitter. So if you have not gotten on Twitter, I encourage you to do that, but be very selective in terms of who you follow. That is, whose Twitter messages you want to read. Only the people you really respect and ideally are in your area of professional interest or personal interest. Now, you need to understand also about Generation Z's values, about what they care about with regard to the world of work. They have learned to disdain business. There was a 2015 AFP census. AFP is one of the leading news services in the world based in France. And their synthesis said, quote, "For Generation Z, the idea of business brings up negative responses, terms like complicated, brutal, and a jungle." So don't expect Gen Zers to have the same, at least tolerant, attitude toward business that previous generations have. They're going to start out with a big bias against you. That said, they, according to a 2015 Northeastern University nationwide survey, they found that 42% of Generation Zers want to run their own business because they think that they'll be more ethical or they'll do it better and it's not going to be as labyrinthine. And a Sparks and Honey survey, Sparks and Honey is a major New York marketing firm, found that 61 to 72% of people want to start a business. I just hope that the Zers are more ethical than at least the bad actors that colleges and the media choose to focus on. Unfortunately, if I think about it, Generation Z has quite a proclivity for downloading pirated music, pirated books, even my children's book. I just went online and I saw that it's been pirated already, free download of my books, and downloaded, you know, video movies rather than paying for them. They don't realize that really is stealing. People who wrote the book or created the music or whatever are against the odds trying to make a living through their writing or their music or whatever, and yet somehow our wonderful Generation Z predominantly seems to feel fine about stealing that, but I'll put that aside. That is not to say, by the way, just because they're doing that kind of stuff, that Generation Z is more frivolous than previous generations. According to a Marketo survey, that's another marketing company, 60% want a job that impacts the world. But they are aware that affording college, finding a good job, and affording a house is much tougher than it was for their parents, according to that survey. Another survey by Adecco USA said that compared with millennials, that is the people who are roughly, you know, 25 to 40, Generation Zers are far more concerned about the cost of college. And according to that AFP synthesis I mentioned earlier, most Generation Zers say, quote, that they are stressed out by what they see as a bleak future. And yet, Generation Zs refuse to prematurely capitulate to being excessively pragmatic. Many of them say they want it all. They want their dream job, whether it's in entertainment or tech or nonprofit. But they really do want it all. They don't want to work the long hours their parents work. According to that Marketo survey, 76% of Generation Zers aim to, quote, make their hobby their job. And they believe, and unfortunately it's too often true, that who you know is more important than what you know. They've also learned to be assiduously politically correct. For example, in business, they believe that hierarchy is bad, teamwork and consensus decision-making is good. They celebrate cultural diversity in every possible way. For example, according to that Northeastern survey, 74% of Generation Zers support equal rights for transgendered people. It is cool for Generation Zers to wear Arab scarves, speak Spanish, follow African-American fads. And that's perhaps not surprising. It's not just that the universities and the media pounds that home. America is becoming ever more non-white. According to a New York Times article, quote, between 2000 and 2010, the country's Hispanic population grew at 4 times the rate of the total population, according to the Census Bureau. And I'm continuing to quote from the New York Times. The number of Americans self-identifying as mixed, white and black, biracial, rose 134%. The number of Americans of mixed white and Asian descent grew by 87%. So what's this all mean? Of course, broad brush generalizations are far from perfect. Two people within Generation Z, within any generation, can be wildly different. But as we think about interacting with young people, it may be useful to remember that Zers prefer their information short, with more visuals, less text. They're not going to trust us as being the font of wisdom, because there is so much power right there on their smartphones. And they absolutely, in general, do at least profess politically correct values. Most are idealistic, and yet they worry that they're going to live harder lives than did their parents. So, just maybe, rather than indulge that common temptation to dismiss the next generation, we might want to cut Zers a little slack. Anyway, that's my best shot at what Generation Z, the young people who are currently 13 to 20-ish, are like. So now I'd like to invite you to call. Would you like to agree, disagree, or amplify on my description of this generation, while fully acknowledging there's always going to be exceptions, without question? Or, as I said, if you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I usually can solve it. I do what are called workovers. All you got to do is call in the phone number here at KELW and work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for calls to come in, a related concept is that certainly the Generation Z people, as well as millennials, and maybe everybody, is ever more likely to be working as a gig worker. I've said this frankly, I've said this for probably 15 years, but it is absolutely accelerating. And there was this website that focuses on gig work. It's called Gig Walk. And they did a survey, and as usual today, and consistent with Gen Z, they didn't put it in a long, fat report. They put it in an infographic, a one-page thing that graphically shows the change of gig workers. Well, first of all, perhaps surprising, they were asking people who work on gigs, that is temporary project jobs, little or no benefits, what were they doing? The surprise for me is, I kind of figured that most of them were going to be like, you know, driving jobs, running errands, stuff like that. The majority, were professional-level jobs. So truly, even college graduates, master's degree holders, etc., are doing jobs that are gigs, part-time temp, and it really makes me sad because most people don't want to spend most of their time looking for their next gig, and most people do like the familiarity and stability of, you know, having learned how one particular workplace operates and how to function well within it, but the friendships they make, the procedures, and constantly looking for gigs, I don't think can be fun for many people. Maybe when you're 20 or 22 and you're trying to sample lots of different jobs, but I can't help but think that that is bad both for individuals and for a society, because the ultimate, to use today's words, community that people belong to is their workplace. And if they're there for just a month and then they're off to the next one, there is no community like that. Anyway, phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, if you would like to comment about Generation Z, or if you want to work over any kind of work-related problem, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. To the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hi, it's you. Are you there?
Hello?
Hi, yes. You're on the air.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to comment about your Google topic. I'm 41, almost 42, and my daughter's 11 and a half now.
Mm-hmm.
But when she was three, maybe four, mm-hmm. I told someone, they said, hey, do you know how to do this? And I said, no, I don't. And she just looked up at me and said, Daddy, just Google it.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean by digital natives. No question.
Yeah, I don't know what category that the 11-year-olds fall into, but she can use the computer way better than I can.
Well, you know, we used to be able to say, you know, I'm just not a computer person. Or, yeah, I can Google. But unfortunately, you know, just like in the old days, there was, you know, knowing how to use a telephone was necessary. This is as necessary today as using it well as learning how to use a telephone. Maybe the analogy is not quite right, was in the past. We can't say I'm not a computer person. You've got to be an expert at knowing how broad and how narrow to make your search so you don't get overwhelmed by too many or too few listings. You need to know how to use their syntax, when to use quotes, when to use the word and, where to use the word or. If you don't know to do that, it's like you're fighting the battle in the world with one arm tied behind your back and one leg, and your legs duct taped together. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Good morning.
Hi.
Good. I'm a baby boomer.
Okay.
I'm looking at 65 in a month or so.
Okay.
However, I'm blessed to have a Gen Z. My baby daughter is 13.
Okay.
And really listening to you, I like what you're saying, but I'm kind of on the beginning edge of it. Now, I don't consider myself partly mathematics. However, my background is really strong in philosophy, science, and history.
Okay.
And for her, at this particular point, I am, as you I would only put it, a fount of wisdom. And I certainly hope that lasts with
right.
me for a while.
Right, of course.
Besides the devices, which she is, oh my God, her thumbs and fingers are just incredible.
Right.
She does pick up a book, because I have a library of books, and she does pick up a book, open it up, and she does read. But that's just one of the series of feedback, and thank you very much. You've got a great show today.
Thank you very much. You know, that is a good point. You know, I am as addicted to the internet and to Google and to Facebook and to video and to YouTube and as anybody, and yet I also retain the book as a tool in my life, both for pleasure. I do read novels, you know, when I feel like it. I read All the Light We Cannot See, a fantastic Pulitzer Prize winning novel, and it gave me a pleasure to know that I can't get off of Twitter. So, I rarely will read a whole book cover to cover anymore. I do think, and I would like to share this with you, I do think that in the area of the how-to genre, that the art of knowing how to extract the most from a book is critical. So I'll tell you what I do. Like, I'm very fortunate, I'm grateful to many of my listeners and readers and clients who recommend books to me. What is the first thing I do when I get a recommendation for a book? I go to Amazon and I read the reader reviews, because those are often syntheses of the main points of the book. And so in 1 minute for free or 2 minutes, I can get a tremendous amount of value per minute received. So I I recognize the power of a book to represent the synthesized extended wisdom of somebody, and I really respect that. And I will, but I will start not by reading it, because that's a big commitment of time, especially when there are so many faster approaches and more efficient approaches to get information. But I will start by going to Amazon, read the reader reviews. If I'm then still inclined to read it, I will then order it. And frankly, because Amazon's amazing, they have such an enormous inventory of used as well as new books, I can get a used book for a fraction, usually, of the cost of the new one, and deliver it to my house in almost no time. Much as I love local bookstores, I love walking in them, etc., to have millions and millions and millions of books all available new and used at amazing prices delivered without my having to get in the car and find a parking spot is just unbeatable. So I am a huge Amazon fan. Now, when I get the book, do I read it from cover to cover? Absolutely not. I start by reading the cover. If it's a hardcover, I read the flaps. I read the back cover. And then I look at the table of contents. And then I make a judgment call as to where to start my look. And I will go to that chapter that is of most compelling interest to me. Sometimes it is the last chapter, because that tends to be an overview. That's a good way for me to, again, get to the essence of the book right away. I will go to that chapter, and I will just scan the headings. And then I will decide, where do I want to make a dive? And that's how I normally read books. Even when I have a guest on the show, I absolutely look at the books carefully. I will read, usually fully read one chapter and scan a number of others, especially the introductory and last chapters. But there's an example of a modern way of using that time-honored, and I hope will stay time-remaining, resource, the book. But it is today needs to be viewed as only a resource amid many that are more potent and certainly more efficient uses of your time while still allowing for pleasure in your life, that is, the reading of a novel, whether it be on your Kindle or your iPad or the old-fashioned way. All good stuff. Phone number. If you have a work problem of any sort, want to run your business idea by me, we can play Shark Tank with me. I'll have a good time doing that. You want to talk about your success experience in landing a job. Maybe you want to talk about your failure experience, and maybe I can turn it around. Or any kind of work-related problem on the job, for-profit, non-profit, 16 or 76, whether you're a Generation Z or a, quote, one of the greatest generation, I usually can help you. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I wanted to share a couple more of the... let me just go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello, it's you. Are you there?
Would that be me?
It would be you.
Oh, that's funny. The voice doesn't sound any different.
very good.
Yeah, I'm a late boomer or early Gen Xer, depending.
Okay.
1963.
Uh-huh.
I'm wanting to know, do you follow any Gen X people on Twitter or any other media? And does the audience know any which are particularly insightful or, amusing?
That's a good question. I certainly will welcome. The persons who I'm finding most interesting are right now is the person who's probably in your right in your ballpark there, Christina Hoff Sommers. She is what she calls the factual feminist, and I'm very interested. I'm a moderate by nature, and she is somebody who presents all sides on the... we are such a generation affected by race, gender, sexual orientation, etc., that I'm interested in those issues, and I find her a voice of reason and very compelling, and so she's somebody I follow. I also follow Steven Pinker.
Christina, I didn't get
Hoff Sommers. Christina, HOFFSOMMERS. And Steven Pinker, who, again, I find a moderate and very thoughtful, out-of-the-box... he's one of those rare people who can be out-of-the-box thinker about everything, about world peace, about psychology, about intelligence. He's just a really smart guy without being a narrow ideologue. Those are the people I really love. I just think we have been really balkanized and bifurcated into hard-left people, hard-right people. There's another guy, Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, who's another one of those guys.
Are any of these people actually... is any one of them from Gen Z?
Gen Z, no. But you asked whether anybody from in your general area.
If I asked Gen X, I misspoke. Yeah, I'm wondering Gen Z.
Oh, no, I'm not following. I must admit, I'm not following any 13 to 20-year-olds. And they're not a primary interest of mine, to be honest. I just felt, you know, when I do this show for, I've been doing this 26 years, I think it's very important for me to span the full range of everything, ideologies, populations, everything.
Sure,
and so
sure.
I felt it was appropriate for me to do a deep dive into Gen Z for today's show, but it's not a primary
yeah.
interest of mine.
Well, maybe someone from the audience.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Feel free to call in. Thanks for the call. Yes, anybody, you know, that's great. Anybody either follows on Twitter or, you know, their blog or reads their article, somebody from Gen Z, somebody who's a teenager, essentially, who is not an idiot. You know, there is a there is this amazing, the most popular blog in the world, no, a YouTube channel in the world is something called QDPie. I'm not even going to spell it because it's so disgusting. But he's got 10 million subscribers, and all he does is say words that I'm not allowed to say on the radio. That's all he says. And he twerks, and he calls, and begs women to twerk, and he that's all he does. 10 million subscribers, almost all among the 13 to 20-year-olds. They have really, by the way, I didn't mention this on the radio because it just wasn't that germane because the show's about work. But the amount, they are so sexually advanced, it's unbelievable what they have seen everything and done everything. Not again, everybody, but as a generation, no generation has done so much sex and seen so much sex and done it so differently as Generation Z. Anyway, the phone number, if you have a work-related problem, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And yeah, if you follow either on blog or Twitter or read a book by a Gen Zer, they're already starting to write books, or maybe not, maybe. feel free to call in and share that with all of us, 415-841-4134. I wanted to share a couple more of those statistics from the survey by GigWalk. When you think of gig workers, you think of people who are not very educated. Well, this surprised the hell out of me, that the majority have 71% completed college or graduate school who are doing gig work. As I've said for now years, we have such an oversupply of college and graduate school degree holders that, unlike in previous generations, in the boomer generation, where a college degree was a pretty much a guarantor of reasonable employment, now it's basically a hunting license for a gig. You can quote me on that. All right, enough of that. Oh, yeah. And the gig workforce, you also think of young people doing gigs? Catch this. The majority of workers doing gigs are over 45. 54% of workers doing gigs are, that is gigs meaning, you know, part-time, temp, no benefits, whatever. 54% are between 45 or older than 45. 24% are between 30 and 44. These are not young kids. Only 22% are under 30. Welcome to the future. That all said, it's very important in my judgment to whatever your job, whether it's going to be a gig or a permanent job, still I feel the job seekers are too wimpy. They are so nervous about making a good impression and getting that good job, because they're always hearing about, you know, the dearth of good jobs, that they get too passive. They go in there for that interview and they, or even in looking for a job, they just want anything and they just want to impress. And yet, most people regret having taken a particular job because they didn't realize what a bad organization it is, what a bad boss it is, what the job's really like. So I urge you, even in this era of dearth of good jobs, to vet them as much as they vet you, because not only will that help you decide if this is really a place you'd rather want to work or rather you'd keep looking for another job, but it actually is more impressive. It does. Nobody likes a desperate job seeker or a desperate romantic partner. So what does vetting an employer, a prospective employer, look like? Number one, before you even apply, ask your colleagues and your friends for places of employment that are good. Or sometimes it's not a whole organization that's good, sometimes it's a work group. I know somebody who works for the federal government who hated working for the federal government because it was so inefficient and people were just entitled and didn't do any work. But then he got transferred into the Forest Service. And for whatever reason, his job at that far in the legal department at the Forest Service was fabulous. He loved it. So key is to start out by getting recommendations either from your colleagues, friends, or Glassdoor. Glassdoor.com lists all kinds of information about what it's really like to work at a place and also gives tips about how to interview well. Also, as you're asking your colleagues for recommended employers or work groups within an organization, describe the sort of environment you work best in. Are you a fast-paced person? Do you want go-go, or do you need it more relaxed? Do you need a very intellectually high-powered, or is that not good for you? Do you want a place where people work long hours, or are you Mr. or Ms. Work-Life Balance? Are you a techie person? Do you embrace technology? Do you use it well? Are you going to fit well in a tech-centric environment or not? It's critical. One size does not fit all. It's critical for you to, as you're vetting employers, to try to find a workplace that is going to suit your natural temperaments. And that's not going to be so apparent necessarily in the job ad or even in the interviews. But your friends and colleagues in Glassdoor may help you. I'm going to give out the phone number again. I do what are called workovers here on KELW, and I'm doing them right now. If you have a work problem, and that could be you're unemployed, could be you're well-employed and still unhappy, it could be you're just starting out, it could be you're facing retirement or looking forward to retirement, interested in how to make the transition, self-employed, employed by a nonprofit, government agency, small company, large company, got a business idea you want to run by me? All those are good reasons to call. The price is certainly right. Zero, zippo, nada. I call them workovers. And the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the idea of vetting employers. It's critical that you read between the lines of advertised jobs. Ads that, for example, ask that the candidate be high energy and self-motivated, that's going to suggest that the job's going to be a pressure cooker. You're not going to get much support. It's the right job for some people, but certainly not for all. As I said, check the company out on Glassdoor. And then during the interviews, ask questions to tease out information about the job, about the boss, the coworkers, the workplace culture. For example, you might ask questions like, what would you expect that accomplish in the first 30 days? Or, every boss is different. In what way are you different from other bosses? And now, finally, and this is a really wonderful part, I believe, a component of vetting an employer. After being offered the job, but before accepting it, ask if you can visit your workplace, both to negotiate terms and to get a feel for the place. And then hang out in the break room, ask employees questions like, I've been offered a job here, but I haven't accepted yet. Is there anything you think I should know that might not appear in the employee handbook? I like that phrase. Of course, you're not always going to get revealing answers. A lot of CYA people, but it can't hurt to ask. So really, vetting an employer really boosts your chances of being happy in your new job. And then the other component of you being happy in your job is you, your skills and your attitude. If you found a good fit job and then you have good skills and good attitude, you do those, do a decent job in those areas, and I'm betting all will be well, even if it's a temp gig. Anyway, phone number again for workover if you need some work help, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm Susan. Do I have you?
You do.
Oh, great. Thank you. I have a second job interview on Thursday. I had a job interview with a company 4 months ago and didn't get the job. Don't recall even getting anything saying you didn't get the job. And all of a sudden they called and said, are you still looking for work? And it turns out it was for a more of a managerial, I use the term lightly, position with this company, but it would pay way better than the front desk greeter person would pay. And I really need work right now because I'm self-employed and I'm not pulling in enough money through my business. So I have a tendency, according to my friends.
What happened? We lost you? Looks like we've lost her. Okay, well, feel free to call back. I might mention parenthetically when she says that she had an first interview and then they didn't even give her a courtesy of a rejection. That speaks volumes, right there. If she's desperate and needs a job, that's one thing, but it suggests that that may not be the greatest employer in the world or treat her very well. Let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Chimi Lee in Berkeley. Marty, I really admire your advice, but I do want to say, generally in all of your programs, But I do want to say, just in my own personal opinion, I hated to see all these bookstores go down in Berkeley, especially Black Oaks and others around the country. And, you know, I'd rather, trying to be a non-consumer, because of the ethics, I really do not like the ethics of the founders of Facebook or Amazon because of their unethical backgrounds and their and the way they do business. But I'd rather go to the library and ask the library to order the books than to use those two entities.
Well,
anyway.
There's, you know, I don't think there's any saints. I don't, you know, I'm not going to get into the ethics of a particular company because it's off topic for career. But I also have certainly, I know how busy and how strapped everybody is. And to have the freedom of having 1,000 times as many books to select as existed in Black Oak and not have to get in your car and not find a parking spot or get mass transit or whatever. By the way, my board operator said that Black Oak still exists, just scaled back. But the, you know, we...
It's always a library.
Yeah, and there is, certainly libraries
are
wonderful.
The local library is not that far away.
Absolutely.
I'd like to it. In fact, I don't get in my car.
Okay.
I'm 74 years old, and I don't get in my car.
Great. Well,
I'm disabled, and I ride to the library.
Nobody is happier to support libraries than me. In fact, next week, my guest is going to be a librarian to talk about what it's really like to be a librarian. So for that reason alone, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. You know, my visceral reaction was... It's like she almost did seem like somebody defending the buggy whip store. You know, in the old days, it was more traditional. It was supporting the local business. And it was, you know, imagine a world with no buses and airplanes and cars. And it feels like Amazon's value to humankind is so enormous to be able for the world to get many, many more products cheaper and see millions of reader reviews so you can make smarter choices and not have to get on your bike, if assuming you can get near to your bike. Like, you know, I just, for example, I wanted to get microwavable paper cups. And so I went to my local store, and they only had little tiny ones, and they were ugly and disgusting and ridiculously expensive. I went on Amazon, and in 30 seconds, I found... Though the exact cups I want, beautiful, for half the price, I can afford it. But when I look about, it's elitist of us to simply say, well, you know, I don't think I like the fact that the what Amazon's founder's values were. I think he's a libertarian, if I recall correctly. But he's a child of an immigrant, if I remember. You know, to say I'm going to try to encourage people to boycott that so they can spend twice as much for far fewer little quality. I think the wise human being thinks in the largest perspective. What is the net impact on the world of every decision we make to boycott or not? Anyway, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Marty. It's Susan. We got cut off. I'm
right.
The woman who was describing... Yep. The job interview.
For those who are just joining us, she had her first job interview 4 months ago, and then they were rude enough to not even let her know she didn't get the job. Now, and that was kind of a receptionist job. Now she's got a second interview it's kind of an entry-level management job. She was self-employed, not making enough money, and so she's really eager to get this job. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah.
Okay, continue.
So my question was, I wanted to be able to, if it's even possible, negotiate, and I've had everybody say to me, oh, it's a buyer's market, which it is not on these low-level jobs. These are jobs probably paying under 40 grand. I
right.
doubt it's a buyer's market.
Right.
And the other job paid 17 an hour. So I'm assuming that this one might be paying 19 or 20, mm-hmm. and this one's salaried and that one was hourly. I'm just wondering, I have 10 years of experience in doing the kind of thing they're doing. I'm more qualified to be the person who would be hiring me than I am for this. You know, in other words, I'm overqualified for the position, but they've called me in. I didn't call them. So I'm just wondering, do I have any negotiating power?
Yes. You have. Okay. And the way to do it is, first of all, there's some tactics that are very valuable. I'm going to give you like a 1 to 2 minute lecture now on the art of negotiation in your situation, and hopefully there'll at least be one nugget. First thing, you don't want them to ask you what are your salary requirements, because that really puts you in between a rock and a hard place. You end up giving too low a number and you're just giving away money. You ask too much money and they eliminate you. So what you want to do is, usually they won't ask that first question out of the box, but after the first answer that you've given in the interview that you've felt you did well, you say, by the way, what is the salary range that's been budgeted for the position for a person like me who's had 10 years of experience? That way you can often get the number to come from them. And they're, at least you know what the range is. So that's the first thing. Then when they make the offer, and I do encourage them to put it in writing so that you've got something. Then what I encourage you to do is to ask if you can come in to negotiate terms. And as I just said a few minutes ago, also get a feel for the environment. Is this really a place where they do treat workers like crap, as evidenced by the fact that they didn't even give you the courtesy of a rejection letter? Or is it okay? So you go in there and then you say, you know, I'm pleased to have this job. Please, you don't say I'm ecstatic or excited. That loses your power. I'm pleased to have this job offer, and I'm glad you realize that I did have 10 years of successful experience at this. I think I can do an excellent job. Given that, what is the most that you feel comfortable paying? That's a great phrase. And secondly, if you can, by the way, think of a way to tweak the job description to give you more responsibility, since you said you could do the job of the boss. Maybe by adding more responsibility to the job or higher level responsibility, that could justify them putting you in a different salary category. And then, after they make their offer, because I do not believe it's a buyer's market, I don't think you play hardball. I think after you've done that, you say, well, let's put salary aside for a moment. Can we talk about one or two other things? And you pick one or two non-cash things that matter to you. Like maybe you want to work from home one day a week. Maybe you want paid training. Maybe, you know, you want to first ask them, before we get to that, you ask them, tell me about the full package of what you're offering me. So you're not trying to negotiate for something they automatically would have offered you. But then after they've made the full package, what benefits, et cetera, time off, the PTO, whatever, then you say, you take one or two, you can't negotiate 10 things, you're going to be seen as too high maintenance. But then you say, you know, one thing that I think would be, I'd be a more effective worker, not having to commute an hour each day, I'd like to work for a day a week at home. Or say, you know, I really like using technology, but currently I don't have a smartphone available. Would you be willing to pay for my smartphone? You pick a couple of things that you would value. And usually, because you don't have much power, you ask for it, but if they say no, you don't fight. That's the balance between negotiating but not risking losing the job. That reduces your risk greatly of losing the job offer. Anything in that little two-minute lecturette that you feel is appropriate for you at this point?
I think it's great. It's been my experience, and this is pretty weird, because I said to the guy, what would you like me to bring to the interview? And he said, really? Nothing. This is just for you to ask questions. So the message I got, which was really shocking, was if you don't ruin it, you've got this job.
Another bad sign. That's a bad sign for an employee. That doesn't sound like they're doing a very good job. Their job would be to vet you and you to vet them. Those are two warnings. I know you need the money and you'll probably take it anyway, but don't. You may find that it's not something that you're going to want to stay with long term. So keep your network up, keep your skills up, keep schmoozing with other people, so that if something better arises, you can move. Because this is not sounding great at this moment.
I would do that, but if they made an offer right then and there,
yep,
and they didn't make it like where I could
right
go home or something, and
sure,
they said, look, we need somebody. They said they just promoted somebody, or they put her in a different building. She was the one doing the job, and so they want to replace her probably as quickly as possible, and for
yep
some reason they thought of me.
Great.
If he makes the offer right then and there,
right,
then I have to negotiate it then and there,
yep,
right?
Sure.
I wouldn't say, can I come in and negotiate
no
it? Because I think the deal might be, because he was making it, when somebody says to me, this interview is really for you to ask questions.
I don't ever trust that. You know, things change. That can change in a night, in a moment. But let's assume that's right. So then you do say, you know, everything I said before is still applicable. In the beginning of the process, you ask that question, what is the salary range budgeted for a position for a person with my background? And then when they make the offer, say, ask them to lay out the full offer, and then you negotiate one or two items. And then, unless it's clearly a satisfactory offer, you can say something like, you know, would you mind if I take a day or two to meditate on this? Any reasonable employer is not going to expect you to sign instantly. That's like the magazine salesman who says, sign, act now, or the offer is going to go away. So I would still take a day to breathe, and then probably, you know, again, not say, great, I'm excited. I'd say, that sounds fair enough. I'll accept the job. I'm looking forward to starting. That sounds the best way to proceed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, and I want to help you. So whatever your work problem, at any, you know, I really have had the widest range of clients, from people who are depressed and lying in bed, who are just starting out or zonked out on drugs, to people who are in the C-suite, that is CEO, CFO, CTO, leading top executives at Fortune 50, certainly, companies, in the for-profit and non-profit sector. So there is really, at this point, having been doing this for 30 years, there is no work problem that I haven't heard. And welcome to try to tackle yours. And you, by calling in the radio here, you get it for free, which is my pleasure to do. That's my part of my pro bono work. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco. And I don't get paid to do the show. This is my community service. This is my public service work. So if you want to take advantage of that, this is your time. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What's on your mind?
Hi, I enjoy listening to your show
when possible
on Sundays.
Thank you.
I'm a retiree. I'm 65, mm-hmm. and I started working, changed career, and I'm now working as a preschool teacher.
Yep.
And I really enjoy my work.
Right.
My concern is, and I'd like to know what agency would I address this to, is that when it's time for me to prepare my lesson plan or to submit information for a newsletter, the teachers are not given time at work. We're expected to do it like over the weekend, or do it at home whenever you can, or you know, put it together on your lunch hour.
Mm-hmm.
But if I do it on my lunch hour, I'm not getting paid for it. And if I do it at home, I don't get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And can a job actually request you to do outside work on your free time?
It's a great question. I don't know if they can. I don't know if it's something you could sue or go to the labor board about. You know, what I would do probably is, I'm not sure everybody is cranking out all kinds of newsletter articles or whatever. If it were me and I didn't want to lose my job and I also didn't want to put a lot of work, I would do something that was easy and fun. Maybe you like taking pictures with your camera, so maybe what you submit to the newsletter would be some pictures you took of the kids. Or maybe it would be a little haiku, five-line poem. I'm thinking of a woman who was such a loyal listener, Shan, who called to the show with haikus all the time. She died recently, and I just wanted to give her a shout-out wherever she is. But something simple and fun, so that you're not, you're not putting in this huge amount of time, but asking to get paid for it may be a little risky. What's your reaction to that?
Well, when I do the newsletter, I have been keeping it very short and simple. But when you do the lesson plan, that's a lot of...
That's expected. Lesson plans are normally expected as, you expect every teacher, kindergarten through graduate school is expected to not just wing it, but have a plan for going in, and that's normally built into the salary of every teaching job I've ever heard of.
Okay, so it's not built into our teaching. It's not built into the salary.
It is built. I mean, they're saying, let's say they're paying you $25 an hour. I'm just making up a number. You know, they're expecting that you're going to spend some time preparing to walk into class. Like, you know, I don't get paid to do the show, but I wouldn't dream of coming in without being prepared. You know, and so.
No, I don't think about coming in unprepared. In no way. I feel like when I come to school, I come prepared. I come prepared to the fact that, even at home, I'm always thinking about what I can contribute to my class.
Great.
Working with
people. So is it putting it in writing? If it's putting it in writing, again, I've seen, you know, I have supervised student teachers, and some teachers go nuts writing these really super detailed lesson plans. Others are much briefer. What if you simply had a list of bulleted items in the order, you know, this morning I want to do this lesson on, plant growth. And so you're going to say, first we're going to take out the celery, and then we're going to take out the colored water. You know, you just, in a few words, so that you're not killing yourself doing this. But just, it's a way, every principal wants teachers to create a lesson plan, because it just shows, by writing it down, it forces you to be organized and logical. And I understand at preschool it's not certainly not going to be that complicated, but I'm wondering whether that's just simple. That's part of being a good teacher, is you may be prepared in your head and have things going around in your brain, but taking just a couple of minutes to write a list of bullet, number one, I'm going to do this, number two, I'm going to do that. And it doesn't even have to be for the whole day. I'm guessing your whole day doesn't have to be lesson planned, you know. But
Right. And I'm not saying that I don't have an issue with doing the lesson plan.
Okay.
I understand the reason for doing a lesson plan.
Okay, you said you did.
I understand that when you walk into your room, you should be prepared.
Yeah.
And ready to go and not fumble and like, oh, okay, what am I going to do today? And it is it's also something that can be information that can be shared, not with just the director, but also with
parents,
so that they are informed on a regular basis what their child is, what their child is going to receive.
Exactly.
And so when they, when their child comes home, they can sit down and ask questions. I guess my concern was just that our teachers are, because I'm new at this, so teachers are expected to do.
Yes.
And I know that there's things that you do on your own time because you want to do it. I go shopping for school supplies not because someone says I have to do it. I'm thinking of something and I say, you know what, I'm going to go and Lakeshore or...
You know, I'm going to interrupt you because we do have a lot of calls on the line. I'm going to say, yes, it is the norm. You say you're new at this. It is absolutely the norm that the prep time is baked into your salary. It's expected that you will write it. Don't have to be model lesson plans, but simple lesson plans. Yes, that's expected. Now, if we all have different issues that bother us more and less, if you are offended by the fact that you feel that you're getting paid crap, you're getting paid $12 an hour, and you're feeling that is outrageous for them to ask you to create lesson plans, then if you're willing to risk, angering or maybe even losing the job, you could certainly politely go to your boss and say, you're only paying me this low salary. I feel that doesn't include time that it takes to develop a lesson plan. Is there any way you could see clear to pay me for that? And as long as you do it politely, you don't have a lot of risk in losing the job. That's my best advice, and I want to thank you for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello. It's you. Hi.
Me?
Yes. Yes, it's you.
Okay. Sorry. I'm Tanya. Actually, you kind of answered one of my questions a little bit. Like, I'm at a job that's very kind of demanding and sort of known to be that. And sometimes I feel like when I feel obligated every time anyone asks me, and sometimes three different people are asking me, I have to say yes to everybody. And I just don't, I know I can't truly be effective, but I don't really know how to, like, say, I'll get back to you, or I'm not sure if I can do that for you, or, things like that. Like, I think sometimes it does get to a point where it's just not realistic when I've got just too many people who aren't talking to each other, expecting things of me, but I don't really know how to say it in a way that doesn't sound like I'm not willing to do my job.
Right. So, again, not again, this is new. First of all, everybody needs to have a set of operating principles that they go into work with. And to the extent that you can, it can't all be perfect, but saying, this clearly is in my job. This clearly is not. This is reasonable for me to do on the spot. This is reasonable for me to get back to and say, I'll get back to you in a day or two. This is something I should delegate. Having a set of general principles to operate from can make it calming for you when you're dealing in the heat of the constant pressure. But then with critical, once you've done that, and sometimes you're going to be, you're going to stick specifically to those principles. Sometimes you say, what the hell, this is, I'm really at this moment not that exhausted. But the key thing is, when it is something that you feel you can't do either now or never, then you have to stick to your guns. And you need to say, you know, my plate is very full now. And by the way, you can go to your boss first. If you really are being, you say the job is known for being demanding, but if in fact it exceeds what is reasonable for you as a human being, you need to go to your boss and document and say, look, this is what, look at all these things I'm being asked to do. And this is just not realistic for one person. Or you can perhaps keep it manageable by, as I said, staying within the boundaries of what you feel is appropriate. And then in a crisp, prompt way, saying, I can't do this or I can't do this now. What makes people crazy is no response. So if somebody emails you with a request to do X and you're overwhelmed and you don't get back to them within a day, which is the normal standard in most workplaces, they are appropriately going to be annoyed at you. You must get back to them within a day to either say, I'll get this for you within 3 days, I'll get this for you by tomorrow, or I just can't do this, my plate is too full, you'll need to ask, whatever. And always propose a positive alternative so they're not left hopeless. That's the crispest way to deal with a difficult environment. And as I said, if you're really, it's just unreasonable, given your limitation, given maybe just for any human being, to do the job, then you need to go to the boss and in a gentle way lay out, here are the parameters that I use for deciding what needs to be done and what needs to be done now. But look at all this coming in. This is just unreasonable. Ms. Boss, what should we do about this? Does that make sense?
Oh, it really does. And it's just something I really hadn't thought of, that you could sort of document and be very kind of systematic about it. And yeah, that sounds really helpful. I appreciate that a lot.
Awesome. Well, I thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Take care. I have time for one brief call. Let's go back to the phones one more. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, it's me.
It is.
Hi. I have a question about my husband. He is a machine operator, mm-hmm. and he's been asked by his company to go out of state and train some guys. They're going to get a new machine there, so he's been asked to train them. And out of 20 machine operators at his company, he's been chosen to go.
Wow, great.
Yeah, it is great because he's very smart, very dedicated. That machine is his. But how can he negotiate like more pay or a bonus or a consultant?
Absolutely, I would. I mean, he's being asked to do more work. He's going to have to leave his family, deal with the hassle of travel, which are mammoth. It's using high level expertise to train people is going to add a lot of value to the company. That's a great case for negotiation. And so I would. It's the same. I like to be what I call firm on the facts and soft on the people. So I wouldn't certainly go in angry, but I would be going in and saying, I'm pleased that you offered me this opportunity. I love the challenge, but I'm feeling like I should be rewarded for that, both because of the higher level work I'm going to do, the incremental value to the company that's going to add beyond what I do as an individual contributor, and the travel hassle and away from being home. In what ways could you see me being compensated for that? And ask it open-ended. That can only gain respect. He may only get comp time. He may say, we can't give you more money. Or he may say, we'll let you do this or whatever. But I absolutely, in this case, think it's a perfectly appropriate thing for him to ask.
Okay. So okay. And then he just has to decide if it's good enough at whatever they offer.
Yeah, I am not a big fan of fighting. I'm a big believer in asking for what you want and making the case reasonably. But then it's usually not worth fighting that much about. Now, maybe sometimes you do. You just go to the wall and say, you do this or I'm quitting. But I'm not normally of that ilk.
He's not going to quit. He's just not going to go.
Okay, right. So he has the right to turn it down.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Moore. Thanks very much for letting me know that Black Oak is still open, even in scaled back form. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And especially in the digital age, librarians can be among our most helpful people. I will talk with a top librarian who's going to tell us what that career is really like today, and likely to be tomorrow. I have to say this. If I were single, I think I may have said this before. If I were single, I would probably be the first place I would go to meet a woman would be a librarian convention. I love librarians. But anyway, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.